Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Rally round the flag, boys, we'll rally once again, shouting the battle cry of freedom. And we'll rally from the hillside, we'll gather from the plain, shouting the battle cry of freedom. The Union forever, hurrah, boys, hurrah! Down with the traitor and up with the star, while we rally round the flag.
That is one of the great songs of the Civil War, probably recognized by all who are listening. But to all who are listening, you realize that the Civil War sesquicentennial has begun. That is the 150th anniversary of the Civil War. The first shots in the Civil War, the firing from Charleston Harbor at Fort Sumter, was on the date April 12, 1861. And from here on, for the next 4 years, we're going to be hearing a lot about the Civil War, as many phases of the war will be commemorated. Tonight, we focus on the beginnings of the war and the fascinating set of historical questions concerning whether the war was intrinsically inevitable, or was it highly contingent and depending upon the actions of many persons as well as upon certain historical accidents. Two very qualified historians who have focused on that period are my guests tonight. They are Bruce Levine, who is professor in the Department of History and African American Studies at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana, the author of two books bearing upon the war and the basic questions that drove the nation into war. One of those books is titled Half Slave and Half Free, The Roots of the Civil War. Our other guest is Adam Goodhart, who is these days at Washington College in Maryland, and is the author of a book which has already ascended near to the top of the bestseller lists. It is titled 1861, The Civil War Awakening. What is the basic thesis, Adam Goodhart, of your book, The Civil War Awakening?
Well, you know, I don't like to talk about thesis too much because I really consider myself more of a storyteller.
You're more of a narrative historian rather than
exactly.
An interpretive one.
Yeah, I believe that a lot of historians, you know, they try to break things down and oversimplify and say, well, the Civil War was about slavery. No, the Civil War was about states' rights. No, it was about preserving the Union. I think that wars are very complicated, sort of multivalent things that almost have a gravitational force of their own that pull in different people for different reasons.
Recently, I had here on the program Adam Hochschild.
Wonderful. One of my heroes as a historian.
He's been here often. He's an old friend of mine, actually. And his newest book is about World War One.
Yes.
And Adam, as you know, essentially argues that was an unnecessary war. There's there's no significant reason why it should have happened at all.
Right.
Is there, I turn to Bruce Levine. Is it Levine or Levine?
It's Levine.
I turn then to Professor Levine. Is there a smack of inevitability about the Civil War? Is that a war which should have happened, which had to happen?
Well, those are somewhat separate questions, right?
To be sure.
For my money, it was a war that should have happened, and it's a good thing that it happened. Ulysses Grant had a conversation after his presidency while he was touring Germany, speaking with Bismarck. And he said on that occasion that not only was the war necessary, but it was necessary that the war escalate to the point that it eliminated slavery. Because if that hadn't happened, the same conflict would have reemerged again and again and again and eventually torn the country apart. Utterly aside from the moral question of the value of obliterating slavery.
As you both know, I'm sure, historians are sometimes tempted, literary people with an interest in history are even more frequently tempted to play with counterfactuals. There are a number of counterfactual histories of the Civil War, which assume either that it didn't happen or assume that the South won. Winston Churchill actually did one such counterfactual imagined historical essay.
And Newt Gingrich, I believe, as well, not to put him in the same category with Winston
that's
Churchill
right.
too much.
Well, he aspires to that.
Yeah, that's right.
And if he gets to be president, He still won't quite make the Churchill level, but he's a significant player, to be sure. There's one fellow who did a novel along those lines. I forget his name now, but the title of the novel was Bring the Jubilee or something like that, which has a change in the way the Battle of Gettysburg is played on Pickett's charge. Something goes opposite as it did in history, and ultimately the North yields and allows the Confederacy to go on being the Confederacy. And he then gives you the history of the Confederacy from there on, and he has them ending slavery 15 or 20 years later in rather sudden final decision that they know they just can't go on in the world pursuing this peculiar institution. And they don't flourish all that well, and after a while they petition to rejoin the Union. Could it have happened that way?
I think there's no question that the Confederacy could have become a viable nation. I don't know how long it would have stayed a viable nation, because I think that the Confederacy was an edifice that was sort of built upon the sand, ideologically and politically and economically to some degree as well. You know, there's a famous speech known today as the Cornerstone Speech, where Alexander Stephens, the vice president of the Confederacy, said that this new republic was built upon the opposite of Jefferson's idea that all men are created equal. It is founded upon the cornerstone of slavery. And so ironically enough, I think he meant something very different, but it actually meant that once that cornerstone of slavery began to crumble, the Confederacy itself crumbled very quickly. So I think that that slavery would have begun to crumble in any case, even with a viable Confederacy, and that probably would have brought things down eventually.
Here's an interesting counterfactual you can play with, and I get this directly from reading something in one of Bruce Levine's books, and I pose it even as we're about to pause for some commercials. But the question is this: what if the Fugitive Slave Act had not been enacted? Would that have increased or decreased the likelihood of the Civil War coming upon us? And you know why I'm asking that, because you've got a thesis in response to that very question. And we'll return to Bruce Levine and to Adam Goodhart directly after these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we return directly to Adam Goodhart and Bruce Levine. And the question to you, Bruce, let's focus in on the Fugitive Slave Act, because you've made a very interesting point about it. Was it in your Half Slave, Half Free book?
Not sure.
Or the other one?
I'm not sure. But the Fugitive Slave Law is part of a package of measures introduced in 1850 as a way to
placate the South.
That one in particular, to placate the South. So if it had not been introduced, arguably the South might have seceded earlier, rather than avoiding civil war, refusing to give the South what it wanted at an earlier stage of the sectional conflict might have precipitated war even sooner.
But the North might have accepted it then, because the point you make is that once the Fugitive Slave Act was enacted and then enforced, it made the North, ordinary citizens of the North, much more aware of the indignity of slavery itself.
Well, that's quite right. And it also affronted them by compelling them, theoretically at least, to join the posses, chasing down people accused of being fugitives. So it certainly produced an irritant. I think that's really the history of the sectional conflict over decades, that every attempt to resolve it actually turns out to exacerbate it. And that's why I think the war, if not inevitable, was very likely to happen and could have, in my opinion, have been ultimately avoided only if one side had backed down in a major way from its values and from the policies that derive from those values, specifically about slavery.
While we're playing the counterfactual game, which I'm forcing upon two historians, let me give you another even bolder scenario. Abraham Lincoln was captain in the Black Hawk War, fought here in Illinois, a war against the Black Hawk Indians. He was captain of a company from his hometown, I guess. And he had he walked out in the mud and the mosquitoes bit him, and he was, but nothing in particular happened, and he went home. But it was a bit of a war. There was some combat, though he didn't get involved in it. Take the scenario that Abraham Lincoln suddenly one day gets an arrow through the heart in the Black Hawk War, and there is no Abraham Lincoln anymore. And this is, what were the dates of the Black Hawk War? 1840-something, I believe. So we take Lincoln out of history. How would the great tension between the North and South over slavery, et cetera, and the adjudication of their claims for slavery to be extended to the Western territories as they are settled, how would all of that have been worked through? Would the Civil War have occurred, or something very much like it, on more or less the same time schedule anyway? Or without Lincoln, would it not have happened?
Well, I don't think that if Lincoln had taken that arrow to the heart in the Black Hawk War, that much would have changed about the lead-up to the Civil War, the outbreak of the Civil War itself. I mean, Lincoln himself was not a sort of a motivating figure within this Republican Party.
He was riding the storm, was he?
He was like, well, not even riding the storm. He was like a little piece of flotsam on top of this great rising tide. He was certainly he did become a major figure in the Republican Party, really, especially in early 1860, just months.
But it was a rising tide.
It was a rising
historical
tide,
inevitability.
No, I'm not arguing historical inevitability. I'm just arguing that Lincoln himself was not the prime moving force. Where Lincoln, I think, did really change the course of history was how he conducted the war once he was president. I think if a different man than Lincoln, or woman for that matter, if that had been possible in those days, if a different person than Lincoln had been president during those 4 years of war, then very easily things might have changed.
Well, are there other historical actors in the decade before the war who played an even more important role in somehow nudging the war into existence?
Sure. Well, everybody thought that William Seward was going to be president in 1860, 1861.
Yeah.
And in fact, William Seward had actually been a more stridently anti-slavery orator and propagandist than Lincoln had been. Lincoln was seen by many Republicans as a sort of a moderate figure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, ironically enough, that flipped once the administration actually got underway. Seward became the figure trying to compromise, and Lincoln was somewhat more uncompromising about the march to war.
And in fact, Seward had begun to pull back from his apparent radicalism a few years earlier. So there was an illusion, as Adam says, that he was the radical figure and Lincoln the moderate. But even in the early stages, Seward is for compromise when Lincoln will have none of it. So I agree with Adam that had Seward somehow been the candidate and been elected, things might have followed a different course at a number of stages.
Yet I also think that if Seward had been elected, the South would have been equally likely to pull out of the, out of the Union.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
The new book by Adam Goodhart is titled 1861, The Civil War Awakening. And it is, to be sure, a narrative history full of fascinating stories about very interesting people, many of whom I'd never really heard or had not heard or read much about them. One such fascinating figure is Colonel Elmer Ellsworth, who came from Illinois, did he not?
Well, he was born in upstate New York, but he ended up in Chicago, as many sort of rootless young men did.
And then when the war began, he headed back to New York, where he organized the New York Fire Zouaves. Who are they? What is that?
Well, you know, Ellsworth had started this sort of Zouave craze.
You have to explain what Zouaves
are. Yeah, of course. They were the sort of the Cirque du Soleil of the 19th century military. There were
nice
these soldiers
put, yeah.
who sort of flipped and spun and twirled their bayonets.
And they were wearing sort of Moroccan uniforms.
Yeah, they were wearing these sort of big baggy pants and red fezes. And he toured with this group through the North the summer before the Civil War, summer of 1860. They performed on the lawn of the White House for President Buchanan, who comes out and says, well, gosh, it's nice that so many Americans are learning to be good soldiers in case the Europeans ever invade again. And so Elmer Ellsworth, at the start of the Civil War, decides that he's going to find the roughest, toughest, meanest, bruisingest guys in the whole United States of America and organize them into a special Zouave regiment. And he chooses the New York City firemen.
And what is so fascinating about this, what it comes to, is that the very first blood in the Civil War is shed by some of his Zouaves.
Well, really, the first Union officer to be killed in the Civil War was Ellsworth himself. Yeah. And it wasn't just a death in battle. It was this sort of very tragic, squalid, double homicide on the stairway of a second-rate hotel in Alexandria, Virginia.
He tries to take down a Confederate flag.
That's right. He takes down a Confederate flag, this huge Confederate flag, and it's right across the Potomac River from Washington, D.C., so this flag could literally be seen by the Lincolns from the window of the White House. Ellsworth goes over literally hours after Virginia has seceded with his regiment. They help to take Alexandria from the Virginians, and he goes and he hauls this flag down, and in the moment that he takes it down, almost, he is shot, and one of his men shoots his assailant. They both fall and are dead almost instantly.
And that's the first blood of the war, is it?
It's not the very first blood of the war, but this was he was the first officer to be killed.
The first blood of the war is something else that you do write about, another incident.
Yeah, well, there were a couple. It depends on sort of how you count the first blood. The first blood that was shed sort of in combat, they usually talk about the 19th of April, 1861, when the Massachusetts troops were marching through Baltimore, were attacked and fired on.
And
by
a young 17-year-old boy.
Yeah, well, a number of soldiers, actually, including
a 17-year-old
boy, exactly, yeah, from Massachusetts, who's killed from a farm in Massachusetts. And but then there had also been a young Irish immigrant soldier who was killed at Fort Sumter, literally as the troops are evacuating. A very sad story where this whole battle has unfolded with no one being killed. The Union troops are withdrawing from the fort. Major Anderson, the commander, insists on firing a 100-gun salute, and at the 50th gun, sort of symbolically, the salute is cloven in half when a gun misfires, explodes, and this young man, a soldier, is killed. They don't even have time to collect his body. They march out. They leave it to be buried by the enemy.
When these things begin to happen, the Confederacy has already existed for some months, has it not?
Yes, it has.
When was the Confederacy organized, proclaimed?
I don't remember. I don't remember the date.
Well, secession begins, really the secession movement begins as soon as Lincoln is elected.
And separate states secede on different time schedules.
But then the Confederacy itself is actually organized as a nation in February of 1860, mm-hmm, and then Jefferson Davis is sworn as its first president at the end of February.
And that's on the basis of the states of the lower South. Yeah. Exclusively, yeah, the seven states of the lower South.
But they're trying to persuade the states of the middle South join in.
That's right.
And some do and some don't.
Well, four do after the firing on Fort Sumter and after Lincoln's call to arms. And there's been a controversy among historians about whether that was inevitable and whether that could have been avoided and whether that was the result of a misstep on Lincoln's part.
We are due for a quick update on the news, and then we will return directly to Adam Goodhart and Bruce Levine, and there's much yet to talk about. Good, interesting stories to tell, but also further analysis to undertake. As we continue, right after, we hear from Paula Cooper.
Milt Rosenberg and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
Let us tell some of the stories about the war, some of the people who fascinate you. Your book, Adam Goodhart, is full of people caught up in the war, those who make the war, those who are ruined by the war, those who are energized and enthused, those who finally are broken in spirit. Of all the characters that you've discovered and about whom you write, who lingers most strongly in your memory?
Wow, there are so many different characters. But I would say, you know, one character I just sort of unexpectedly fell in love with was, of all people, James A. Garfield, whom not a lot of people think of as a Civil War figure. We think of him, of course, as the president who was only in office a few months before he was assassinated. But I became fascinated with Garfield as a sort of a representative young man at that moment that the war began. And as a representative of this generation that would fight and win the war, he became a major general fighting for the Union, and that then would rule the country for the next really two generations into the 20th century. country, these Civil War veterans. And he himself would go from being a sort of an obscure college professor in 1860 and state legislator to receiving the highest prize that his fellow citizens of the Republic could bestow. And so I found that Garfield, at the beginning of the Civil War, was, like many young Americans, he was thinking about politics, but he was also thinking about what this war might mean for his life, for his career. And this is the stuff that we tend to lose sight of when we just think of the Civil War in these sort of vast political and ideological and economic terms. We forget about this rising generation that was looking for a chance to make its mark in the world, looking for a chance to – he wanted to become, I think as millions of young Americans did, he wanted to become a new Napoleon.
Yeah. One rather remembers, it's either Marat or Danton or one of those guys in the French Revolution who's looking out a big window and the crowd is surging down the street. And you remember he gets off this famous line, tell me where the crowd is going. I am their leader and must take them there.
Yes.
That's how you make a reputation. Yeah, wartime is very good for political advancement.
It is. One of my favorite characters is someone by the name of Garland White, who has received relatively little attention. Garland White was a slave who belonged to a Georgia senator by the name of Robert Toombs. And when Toombs brings White to Washington, D.C., White manages to escape in 1859 or 1860, possibly with William Seward's assistance, makes his way to Canada, and then as the war begins, is waiting for the Union to open its arms toward the recruitment of black soldiers. And when it does, Garland White comes back from Canada and begins to raise black regiments throughout the Midwest. He's finally in Richmond with some of the first Union troops in 1865 who are black troops. And at that point, an older woman comes up to him and asks him where he's from, what his mother's name was, and it turns out to be his mother, from whom he was sold 30 years earlier to Robert Toombs. And one of the reasons it's one of my favorite stories is it captures so much about the experience of African Americans and their role in the war.
In another book that you've done, Confederate Emancipation, is that what
yes.
it's called? You reveal something that I had never really read much about before at all, that the Confederacy really intended to free many slaves to get them into the Confederate Army.
Well, the idea was raised repeatedly early in the war, and Jefferson Davis flatly rejected it. It made tremendous military sense because, in terms of white soldiers, the South was so badly outnumbered, and here was this enormous section of the Confederate population, about a third, that was black and mostly enslaved. And slaves had been offered freedom in the past in American history in order to fight. But Davis didn't want any part of it, and neither did anyone else in the Confederate government until they're really on the ropes, until the last months of the war when Davis finally has a change of heart and then introduces a piece of legislation that actually doesn't promise freedom to slaves, calls upon masters to volunteer slaves and to give them their freedom, and then they can serve.
And did that actually happen in any instance? Or?
Well, they're predicting thousands and thousands of black recruits. Mm-hmm. They get about 60 because the slaves know, number one, that the Union is winning the war. Number two, it's the Union that really is emancipating slaves. And number three, they have no reason to trust the Confederate government.
Yeah. Of course, even with emancipation and even with free blacks of the North, the government for quite a while was very hesitant to put them in uniform
That's
and
true.
Get them.
That's
but
true.
We know that later on there were some combat units, and indeed they suffered very heavily.
They aren't raised in a systematic way until after the Emancipation Proclamation,
yeah.
1863. But by the end of the war, if you look at both the Union Army and Navy, there have been some 200,000 black soldiers fighting for the Union. And it's Lincoln's opinion that they couldn't have won that war without that contingent of soldiers.
Hmm. What's that fine film that was made some years ago?
Glory.
I think that's what unit was that? They were from Massachusetts.
That was 54th.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, when you talk about the role of blacks in the Confederacy and the Confederate Army, they actually did play essential roles to the Confederate military effort. And one was as laborers from the beginning of the war. Mm-hmm. They were the ones who did all the manual labor. They were the ones who built the fortifications. And I found a wonderful or terrible quote from a Richmond newspaper in early 1861 where the editor enthused. He said, "Our cavaliers shall wield the sword and our Negroes will carry the shovels." And so there was this sense that these slaves were essential to the military effort. And in fact, once they began to resist serving the Confederate Army and running away, as they did in the very first weeks of the war, very quickly the Confederates found themselves at a loss. They were sort of fighting a two-front war in a very real way. They were fighting on the one hand against the Union forces, on the other hand against their own slaves, their own increasingly resistant slaves.
Right, right.
It is a truism of military theory that, or at least of military history, as pursued by some who are in the military and some who keep a distance but analyze these matters rather closely. It is a truism that ultimately wars cannot be won unless there is, particularly protracted wars cannot be won, unless there is a resonant pattern of support of public opinion in the civilian portion of the of the population. You need backing. And if people don't believe in the war, and as the war goes on, your military operations will fail if you don't have enthusiasm for the cause back home. That was a very important issue in the North, was it not? As well as in the South, I suppose. But in the North, we had some riots against the war, or at least against drafting people for the war. What was the rise and fall of support of public opinion on both sides over the course of the war?
Well, you know, it shifted so rapidly, and I think we've seen in our own times how support for a war can,
yes,
can rise, and then it can dwindle very fast depending on what the day's headlines were. But the most incredible transformation, I think, happened at the very beginning of the war with those shots on Fort Sumter, when the North had previously been extremely ambivalent, extremely divided, with many, many people. Probably the sort of preponderance of Northern sentiment was for compromise in one way or another. And suddenly, these shots are fired at Fort Sumter, and it's what I've called America's first 9/11 moment, or a Pearl Harbor moment, you might think of it, when the whole country, due to this new technology of the telegraph, is able to experience a national trauma almost in the same instant, almost
and
in
waves
time.
Of outrage sweep across the North,
across the nation. Not just waves of outrage, but desire for revenge, desire to avenge this insult to the American flag. And so, Jefferson Davis, in exchange for winning this sort of useless 2-acre pile of rocks in the middle of Charleston Harbor that had been manned by 60 soldiers and a brass band, ends up uniting this previously very divided North, and immediately hundreds of thousands of Northern men are ready to volunteer to fight for their country.
But I think that has to be understood not simply as an attack on the flag. It's seen as, and it is, an attack on the Republic. And the Republic is very highly valued. Have to remember, this is a world dominated by monarchies and aristocracies, and this is the sole substantial republic in the Western world. And so attempting to bring it down, much less to fire upon it, is seen not simply as an affront, though it is, to American patriotism, but as a threat to the liberties of Northern whites, who feel that if this republic goes down, so will their rights.
And not just even just the American Republic, but as you suggested, that idea that government of the people, by the people, for the people shall not perish from the earth. You know, we tend to think of the Civil War in isolation happening in America, but in fact, this was an event on the world stage, and people were aware of that from the very beginning. It was a moment when Garibaldi was fighting his war of liberation and unification in Italy. There were revolutions, nationalist liberal revolutions sweeping Europe. And so the world was watching with bated breath to see what would happen. There's a great letter that Lincoln wrote in early 1861. He had been made an honorary citizen of the tiny little Republic of San Marino in the Italian mountains. And he writes to these regent captains of San Marino, and he basically says, "Hey guys, it's you and us in the world, this little tiny Republic of San Marino and the big United States. And as Bruce just said, most of the rest of the world is monarchies and aristocracies. So this involved not just the history of our country, but the history of something much larger.
And Europeans are watching it with, as I think Adam is saying, with the same concerns that their hopes for republican liberty are riding on the success of the American Republic.
But on the other hand, the British government was tempted to support the South, was it not?
Quite right.
What was their strategy in that?
Well, I mean, here is this rising economic power across the Atlantic that not so long ago was simply a handful of colonies. Now it is becoming a significant economic rival. The possibility that this might break up and the South become a separate agricultural society and market for British manufactured goods is very attractive to the British. And we need to remember that the British in those days, this constitutional monarchy, is not terribly enthused about the outright republic that exists in North America. And so if that republic itself breaks up, that is of little political a moment to the British government either.
On the other hand, I think that it's been overemphasized sometimes the likelihood that Britain might have sided with the Confederacy, because I think the Confederate Republic from the very beginning, the Confederate nation, was so stridently pro-slavery, and the British people really, there was the abolitionist movement had really significantly taken root in England before it ever took root in the United States, and I don't think that the British public or the British politicians, and for that matter, Queen Victoria herself was very strongly anti-slavery. I don't think they would have allowed the nation to cast its lot with the slave republic.
I think for us living so many years later, 150 years after the beginning of the war, at least in the North, we have much more of a sense of what the war was like for the Union forces and in the Union states, so to speak. But the Confederacy remains kind of a mystery. Mm-hmm. I suppose not so for those who are deeply invested in Southern culture and have lived there across a number of generations. When we return, we're about to serve capitalism in our own way. I'd love to get some insight, some reportage about how the South waged the war and what Southern life was like. Politically, socially, religiously, et cetera. Religiously, indeed, is a very interesting special dimension. After all, there were lots of Christian divines down there, and most of them managed to rationalize slavery itself and to rationalize the war. Seems to be kind of run against the grain of serious Christian commitment, but talented divines can handle almost anything when it comes to justifying man's ways to God. We will return directly to Adam Goodhart and Bruce Levine after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we are going to take a little musical interlude before we get back to work. Here is a song titled Johnny Reb.
Oh, I'm a good old rebel, now that's just what I am. And for this Yankee nation, I do not give a damn. I'm glad I fought again, I only wish we'd won. I ain't asked any pardon for anything I've done. I hate the Yankee nation and everything they do. I hate the Declaration of Independence too. I hate the glorious Union, 'tis dripping with our blood. I hate the striped banner, I fit it all I could. I rode with Robert E. Lee for 3 years thereabout. Got wounded in four places and I starved at Point Lookout. I caught the rheumatism a-camping in the snow. But I killed a chance of Yankees and I'd like to kill some more. 300,000 Yankees is stiff in southern dust. We got 300,000 before they conquered us. They died of southern fever and southern steel and shot. I wish they were 3 million instead of what we got. I can't take up my musket and fight 'em now no more. But I ain't gonna love 'em, now that is certain sure. And I don't want no pardon for what I was and am. I won't be reconstructed and I do not give a damn. Oh, I'm a good old rebel, now that's just what I am. For this Yankee nation, I do not give a damn. I'm glad I fought again, I only wish we'd won. I ain't asked any pardon for anything I've done.
That is sung by Hoyt Axton. Do you know anything about that song, its provenance, its origins?
No, I don't. I know, but it certainly does capture a very powerful sentiment in the South.
And that's why I wanted to play it at just this point, because I was asking you earlier, and I reinstate this just very quickly, what do we know about the morale of the South, about the attitudes of the South, about the mores that... that reigned in the South during and after the war?
Well, it's a complicated story because the South is not, including the white South, is not monolithic here.
Mm-hmm.
There is, at the beginning, a substantial number of white Southerners who think that secession's a mistake and they don't want any part of it until events develop further and basically they think have forced their hands. There is, however, eventually tremendous support in the white South, including among the majority of white Southerners who are not slave owners, for the Confederacy. We need to remember that there is tremendous support for slavery among the non-slaveholders of the South.
Why and how? How account for that?
Well, on the one hand, many of them are involved indirectly with slavery. They may be serving, they may be working as foremen. They can be benefiting from the fact that their relative is a wealthy slave owner. Their neighbor wealthy slave owner is ginning their cotton, perhaps, for next to nothing. But ideologically, they're also told that, number one, slavery is the only thing that can keep the black population under control. If we lose slavery, they're going to run amok among you and deflower your women, steal your property, and just as bad, they will be your equals. And by making them your equals, we will lower you in status as well. And this has tremendous power ideologically in the South in pulling non-slaveholders
through. Seems to me it retains power in all of the post-war years.
It absolutely
Jim
does.
Jim Crow is essentially a response to that same set of peers, is it not?
That's right. And so the song that we just heard is really the sentiment that goes into the resistance to Reconstruction and the construction of the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah.
And the white terror that's imposed during the decades following the Civil War.
Now, I was wondering as well about, as I put it to you, I think, while we were off air, the theology of the Confederacy. There were preachers down there. Most of them supported the war and justified it, did they not?
Absolutely. And this goes back...
How did they do it? What was the nature of the argument?
Well, they say, look in the Bible. The Hebrews had slaves. There's nothing in the Bible that indicates either Old or New Testament that slavery is out of bounds for our God. And here are the Hebrews, and here is God helping them to conquer, and they are the chosen people, and so on and so forth. And Jesus has never preached against slavery, they say. We are a Christian nation, and this is an institution that has existed in civilization from time immemorial with God's blessing, they argue. And some historians claim that they have made a very good case that slavery is consistent with both testaments of the Bible.
But had not slavery been totally disdained and disestablished in the Western world, every place except Brazil by the time we had the Civil War?
It's Brazil and Cuba in the Western Hemisphere are the biggest holdouts from that. You're right. The British Empire had abolished it in the 1830s. The French originally did it at the start of their first revolution. Then when the monarchy returns, the monarchy brings back slavery. But in 1848, there's another Republican revolution. And at that point, it's gone from the French Empire. Meanwhile, the Spanish colonies in South America, in the course of gaining their freedom, find that if they can enlist the support of the slaves, they can fight more effectively against Spain. And so slavery is out in most of South America as well. So, yes, and that's one of the reasons, I think, that the Confederacy feels itself, or rather the South feels itself endangered by Lincoln. They're already feeling themselves in their slave-holding society in a weakening position. And they take what they consider to be the necessary steps to strengthen it against the North.
This is a rare program about the Civil War. We've not yet talked about the waging of the war in any way, except for some mention of the bombing of Fort Sumter. And neither of you has essentially been focused upon the military aspect of the war and the achievement finally of a victory. Still, I'm sure you know a great deal about that. And we might turn to when we return after some impending commercials and a newscast coming almost instantly, we might turn to the question of how the war was waged and how the war was won. We will be directly back to Adam Goodhart and Bruce Levine after the evening's news. For that, to the WGN Newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Guests of the evening, Bruce Levine and Adam Goodhart. Bruce Levine's book, Half Slave and Half Free, published a few years ago, has recently been edited and republished with a new preface, I believe, and a new final chapter. He is also the author of Confederate Emancipation and a book now in the works to be published next year is titled The Fall of the House of Dixie. The new book by Adam Goodhart is titled 1861, The Civil War Awakening. It's been very favorably reviewed in all sorts of places. And here's a comment about the book from a friend of mine, Harold Holzer, who is a very active Lincoln scholar when he's not doing public relations for the Metropolitan Museum of Art, as a matter of fact. He says, combining a master historian's sure command of original sources and a novelist's deft touch with character and narrative, Adam Goodhart has produced the young century's liveliest book about how a generation of remarkable and ordinary Americans alike variously provoked, resisted, and endured the dissolution of their country and the tragic march toward the Civil War. Major and minor characters, political movements, and whole towns and villages come alive under Goodhart's expert scrutiny. The result is that rarest of history books, a work of remarkable original scholarship, crafted into an irresistible read. That's a pretty good blurb, I would say.
I was happy when that arrived in my email box.
Oh,
and
yes.
Harold is a magnificent historian, so I was honored to have that from him.
Last time I saw Harold Holzer, he and I were in the East Room of the White House, as a matter of fact, both of us receiving an award from that other fellow who was president before this current guy.
James Buchanan?
No. The names blur. On to the waging of the war itself. That's so vast a subject. Let's look at it from the Confederate side to begin with. Did they feel that somehow the force was with them and that they would prevail?
I think the great majority thought that this was going to be a pretty easy operation.
Easy, actually.
Yes. Many Confederates doubted that the Union would even resist secession, and others insisted that if they did, it would be a pretty small order for the South, whom they said was much more militarily capable to deal easily with this bunch of helpless counterhoppers, as they referred to northern urban dwellers. Didn't turn out quite that way. One of the few people who knew it wouldn't turn out that way was Jefferson Davis, who had had some experience in the Mexican War with both northern and southern soldiers and calculated pretty early that when it came to war, they were going to be about equal in quality. But Davis had very little luck at first convincing most of his colleagues of that fact.
Didn't Jefferson Davis, in the years before the war, serve, among other things, as Secretary of, yes, of War for the United States?
Yes, he was Franklin Pierce's Secretary of War, and apparently a very good one. as well as something of a war hero during the Mexican War. Mm-hmm. So he knew his stuff militarily. But one of the knocks on Jefferson Davis is that he tried to run the war effort very closely himself rather than allowing his generals to have their heads.
Was that not true of Lincoln?
Lincoln recognized his military limitations, though he becomes a very good strategist and better than his early general-in-chief, George McClellan. But once Lincoln gets a team of officers in place in whom he has confidence, especially Grant and Sherman and Sheridan, he pretty much lets them have their way and concedes when they differ that they were probably right.
It's part of the folklore, or maybe, in fact, it's accurate. It's an accurate account of the early years of the war, that or the first year, that McClellan dithered a great deal, didn't use the military force available. And I've always loved the story about Lincoln sending him a letter saying, if you're not using the army, I'd like you to lend it to me for a while.
That's right. Yeah, there were any number of blunders by the Union in the first year of the war. But, you know, I do think that when we're talking about what each side expected, you know, traditionally, the historians of the Civil War have said, well, each side thought it was going to be a cakewalk, which was certainly true of some people. And even many people have said, one historian told me, well, the North, pretty much the Northerners went off to war thinking that this was going to be a sort of a 90-day lark, that they would get marched from Washington to Richmond and on to the Gulf of Mexico in just a few months. But I was actually surprised and impressed by the number of thoughtful Northerners I found who knew that this was going to be a long and terrible struggle, or expected this would be a long and terrible struggle from the beginning. One of my heroes in the book, young James Garfield, literally on the morning after the surrender of Fort Sumter, writes to a friend. He's sitting in the empty Ohio Senate chamber. Everyone else has left sort of to get the latest news, and he's sitting by himself as the rain falls on the window panes. And he predicts to an old friend of his, he says, this is going to be a war in which a million Americans will die. And of course, it ended up being 620,000 Americans. There was another young man, an officer, killed in the first weeks of the war, Theodore Winthrop, a wonderful writer, a poet, a travel writer, who, again, there's a letter that he writes to a friend right after Fort Sumter, and he says, this is a war that will be fought for many years, and then we in the North will have to spend at least a generation of police work in the South, as he calls it. He foresees the end of slavery, and he foresees an occupying army that will have to enforce the abolition of slavery and the institution of civil rights for African Americans. And he says, I will dedicate the rest of my life to this war and to the police work that will follow. And very sadly, he dies in his very first battle just a few weeks into the war. But there was a sense of the sacrifice that was to come.
In terms of the military operation, how was the war won? Was that inevitable? If the coming of the war was inevitable, was also the winning of the war by the North inevitable just by virtue of the greater manpower, the greater industrialization, the greater everything?
Well, we know many cases in which the more powerful nation or the more powerful force on paper loses the mm-hmm. war. The classic example is the United States in Vietnam most recently, but the British Empire against the American colonies. On paper, that should have been a cakewalk for the British, and it wasn't. So there are too many other factors that can intervene.
Well, a small point of disagreement. The British never put as many men in the field in North America as we had to oppose them.
Well, they had the capacity. They had the...
But they didn't draw upon the full capacity.
That may be. And one can also argue that the United States had the capacity against Vietnam to have sent mm-hmm. many more soldiers than it actually did. And the intervening factor is political will and morale and dwindling support for the war. And that's what could have ended the war, I believe, very differently at various points. It looks at a number of key turning points in the war that the Northern support for the war has collapsed. That's true right down to the eve of Lincoln's election in 1864. And if Lincoln believes that he's going to lose that re-election campaign, and he also believes that if that occurs, it's going to be a hell of a job trying to win that war.
It's this terrible calculus that goes on in the war, this sort of ruthless calculus where the North is just expending more and more and more blood and treasure, and it becomes, you know, it's sort of like a losing poker player sitting there at the gambling table, and he's losing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars, and he's trying to decide, well, at what point do I just cut my losses and pick up from the table, or am I going to keep on putting my money down, trying to play my cards and trying to recoup my losses? And this was the kind of, you know, just inner ambivalence is not a strong enough word, but inner torment that millions of Northerners are going through. And of course, the stakes weren't just money. They were the lives of hundreds of thousands of people.
We lost more men in that war than in any other war we've ever fought, surely.
That's right.
600,000.
Yeah, by far.
And probably a million maimed for life.
That's right.
Yeah, it's said that...
In World War II, we only lost about 400,000, I think.
I think it was even less. I think there was about a quarter million in World War II, from what I recall.
In both theaters?
I believe so.
Maybe.
And less than 60,000 in Vietnam.
Oh, yes, sure.
Yeah. And you know, it's said, when you mentioned the maimed, I've read that after the Civil War, more than half of the state budget of, I think it was Mississippi, went to artificial limbs for veterans.
We know that they chopped limbs off for the smallest reason, because they had no antisepsis. It was medicine before the achievement of true modern medicine.
Yeah, it was pretty grim.
Walt Whitman standing around being a nurse in the middle of all of those amputations.
Right.
It's such a strange moment historically, because you have military engineers who are developing cannons that can hit a target from 5 miles away, and you also have soldiers going into battle with swords, and you have this incredible sort of modern technology of killing, and a medical technology that's still closer to the Middle Ages than to today.
And, of course, that lacks anesthesia as well.
That's right.
Yuck.
Happier subject.
Ghastly, so. Ghastly. Yeah. It's time to pause for a quick round of commercials, and also we will go shortly to the telephones. Any questions you've got that you want to raise, any thoughts you want to share, any Civil War buffs out there who have some further light to shed on the matters we've been discussing, we welcome your calls. Get them in quickly. 312-591-7200 is the number. 312-591-7200, and we're ready for your questions and or comments. Similarly, if you're listening to us over the Internet at some greater distance, and particularly for our friends on the Pacific Rim who are listening to us midday or on into the early afternoon tomorrow, the email address by which you can reach us is extension720@wgnradio.com. Extension 720 as one word, @wgnradio.com, or, as I said earlier, 312-591-7200. On to your contributions directly after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we are ready and indeed eager for your questions to Adam Goodhart and Bruce Levine. And coming up is the first caller, that is John, who's reached us at WGN Radio. Good evening.
Hi, gentlemen. My question was, which ethnic group lost the most people? Was it the Irish and the Scotch, which is my guess? And my second question was, the American Indians are never mentioned in the Civil War. Which Indian tribes went with the North and which with the South? Or was it a little mixed up?
Fascinating question.
Well, you know, I'm not sure, actually, which ethnic group it was that lost the most soldiers, except I do think that the roles of these different ethnic groups are a fascinating subject that has only recently started to get attention. And one group
you pictured the Germans of Cincinnati.
With the Germans of St. Louis, actually.
St. Louis, rather. Yeah.
Although the Germans throughout the Union and the Confederacy were a very interesting group. Many of these families, these German families, these immigrants had fled from the liberal revolutions, the aftermath of the liberal revolutions of 1848. Many of the Germans in the North were among the staunchest abolitionists and Lincoln supporters. Many of the Germans in the South, on the other hand, sort of drew on this position to become Southern nationalists, although there were a great number of Germans who remained Unionists in the South, too. But in terms of the question about the Indian tribes, that's a fascinating subject to me because, you know, the Indians in America had for generations been thrown into this position of trying to decide which group of powerful whites to cast their lot with, whether you're talking about the French and Indian War, the American Revolution, the War of 1812. And they faced the same problem at the start of the Civil War. And groups like the Choctaws and the Cherokees especially had strident debates within the tribe over where to cast their lot. And in fact, both of those groups went with the Confederacy, and it was to their great misfortune that they did so. But the calculus was difficult because on the one hand, here's the Confederate nation founded on white supremacy, not very promising to the Indians. But on the other hand, here's this Union, a United States with which they have not exactly always had happy relations, and dominated by this new Republican Party whose platform was all about westward expansion and the railroad and Homestead Act. And so they really were caught between two fires. It was a very unfortunate situation.
And the victory of the Union clears the decks for going after the Indians on the plains. The Indian population had always done best, as I think Adam was saying, when the white population was divided and at war in one way or another. And every time those wars had come to an end, the Native American population was the loser. And so it is after the Civil War. And it really doesn't matter, however, whether the Indians fought for the North or for the South. Once the war is over, they're on the losing end of that story, as they had been consistently after the French and Indian War, after the American Revolution, and so on.
And in the waging of the Indian Wars that follow post-Civil War, which are episodic, to be sure, but there is some significant bloodletting, a number of significant figures from the Union Army.
Custer.
Mm-hmm. Custer, certainly. But didn't Sherman have some role in the West after the Civil War?
I believe so, though I don't know the details of that story.
Yeah. Well, Sherman became the commander of all of the United States Army.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he was coordinating the American strategy in the West.
We go back to the phones, 312-591-7200. And next up is Mark. Good evening, sir.
Good evening. I'd like to ask your guests there why they think the end of slavery in the South would really be inevitable. I've heard this argued a number of different ways, that slavery was on the way out. Oh yeah, oh no, it wasn't. And I'm just wondering, I'm under the impression that they think that slavery would have ended, you know, in a reasonably short period of time. I think one of the people said 10 or 15 years.
I said that, just conjecturing, but let's turn to the scholars.
Yeah, you know, I actually don't think that slavery was on the way out. And one of the most telling signs is when you look at the prices of slaves, you know, that the market is a very good barometer. And the price of slaves was skyrocketing on the eve of the Civil War. It was one of the strongest, most reliable investments that a Southerner could make was in slaves. And in fact, the value of all the slaves in the South was as much as all of the railroads and factories in the entire United States put together.
But do the little mental experiment. Surely, you could not imagine that if the Confederacy had won and if they persisted as a slaveholding nation, that 150 years later, or 154 years later, or rather 146 years later, if you take the edge of the wars, 65, that slavery would still exist.
Well, people at the time actually were thinking about 100 and 150 years in the future. I found a remarkable article from 1860 where they projected the number of slaves that would live in the United States in the year 1960.
Really?
They projected there would be 100 million slaves at that point. They weren't thinking of slavery as something that would necessarily wither and die. And I think, you know, when we think about history, we have to account for these possibilities that seem very strange to us now.
I think it's all about of course, how the war ended and when the war ended. If the war had ended in a Union or a Confederate victory early on, before the war had actually taken a strong anti-slavery turn, then it's, I think, easy to imagine slavery lasting a good long time. I don't know about 1960, but I think a number of knowledgeable people have guessed that it would have or could have gone well into the 20th century, which is another reason why I think it's appropriate to think of this as the good war, that this was the necessary war, that without this war and its steady escalation, slavery would have lasted a lot longer.
I could personally imagine a scenario in which slavery might eventually have been phased into one form or another of slavery light, as it were, where maybe there would have been gradual emancipation, but a system almost, what we had existing in the Deep South until just a couple of generations.
Manumission ago.
Well, manumission, but also a sharecropping system. Uh-huh. And, you know, that system really has only just been phased out within recent memory. So it's not all that far-fetched.
Mm-hmm. Our thanks to the caller. We pause for the usual reasons, an update on the news, a few commercials, and then directly back to Bruce Levine and Adam Goodhart and to your calls to them on 312-591-7200. Now to the WGN Newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Milt Rosenberg and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
Southern men, the thunders mutter. Northern flags and south winds flutter. To arms,
to arms,
to arms,
to arms,
to arms,
to arms in Dixie.
Send them back your fierce defiance. Stamp upon the cursed alliance. To arms,
to arms,
to arms,
to arms,
to arms
in Dixie. Advance the flag of Dixie. Hurrah, hurrah. For Dixie's land we take our stand. And live or die for Dixie.
To arms,
arms,
to arms,
to arms,
and conquer peace for Dixie.
To arms,
arms,
to arms,
and conquer peace for Dixie.
Would you imagine that those words are authentic from the time, or would they have been added on later?
That sounds to me like it's probably somewhat later words, but there were so many variations on these songs, it's hard to keep track. And of course, one of the wonderful things is that both the North and the South sung many of the same songs with different lyrics. The South had its own version of Battle Cry of Freedom, and my favorite story about Dixie comes at the very end of the war, right after the surrender at Appomattox, when everyone in Washington, D.C. was celebrating. Crowds gather on the lawn of the White House, and Lincoln comes out to acknowledge their cheers, and he's waving to the crowd, and then he says, "I see that there are some bands of music in your ranks," and he says, "I always thought that Dixie was a fine song, and unfortunately those our friends across the river seem to have appropriated it for a while, but," he says, "I have consulted my attorney general, and he assures me that it is now ours by right of contraband of war, and so I hope that you will play Dixie for us," and they do play Dixie, and it's just a couple of days before Lincoln's death.
And of course, Dixie was written by a northern minstrel. I forget. Dan somebody. What was it?
That's right. It's almost midnight. You can't expect us to remember.
I expect a caller to tell us almost instantly.
That's right. I'm sure a caller will.
As we go back to the phones, 312-591-7200. And Jeff is next up. Good evening, sir.
Hello, good evening. I'm anxious to ask my question. Do you, Milt, and or the panel believe that it's possible we could ever have another civil war? After all, we had a president and an attorney general who attacked American citizens in Waco, killed them. They also killed and murdered a man's wife and his child. We have plenty of fringe groups out there. Is it possible that the president or our government could order our military to attack citizens again?
Well, if such a president did, that would not necessarily generate a civil war, though it might generate considerable indignation, and perhaps ultimately one would have calls for impeachment.
Well, you know, I think that we're certainly not in any kind of volatile situation now like we were in the 1850s and in the 1860s. As divisive as our politics are today, we certainly don't have people waving around guns on the floor of the House or beating each other almost to death on the floor of the Senate. But, you know, I actually think that the caller is on to something, touches on something interesting in the sense that, you know, when we ask why Americans are so fascinated with the Civil War, I think one of the big reasons is that in our combative democracy that uses the language of war so much, we wage political campaigns, we stand up and fight for what we believe in, it almost always feels in one way or the other as if our country were on the verge of civil war. And that moment of the 1860s was the one moment in our history when it truly spun completely out of control. And I think that that's part of the fascination, that there are these sort of centrifugal forces within a within a democracy that we're constantly...
We still have a race issue in our country.
And, of course, the race issue is also a very, very strong reason that we are still obsessed with the war today.
But you don't think we could ever have another civil war?
Well, never say never, but fortunately, I don't think there's one looming imminently.
All right, thanks to the caller. But isn't it the case that there are some diehards, or maybe they're just playing the role for fun, who argue that the South ought to make another attempt at secession?
Oh, yes, there are. And there's a large, well, there's a vocal constituency of people who are called neo-Confederates.
Yeah.
Who are doggedly upholding the reputation of the Confederacy to this day.
And what is the work of, what is the mission of the organization called the League of the South?
Well, as I understand it, the purpose is to argue for a new secession.
That's what I thought.
To pull out of the Union on the grounds that, once again, the Union is falling prey to all sorts of subversive and anti-libertarian elements, and the only way to save the liberties and the civilization of white Southerners is to pull out of the Union. I don't think you can miss the racial animus, by the way, in this organization and in a number of organizations around it.
I know at least one fairly well-placed editor, I won't specify the journal, who is, in fact, a member of and an enthusiast for the League of the South. 312-591-7200, our number. As we go to the next caller, that being Patrick, who's reached us at WGN Radio. Good evening.
Good evening. First of all, it was Daniel Emmett who wrote Dixie.
That's the name.
Yes.
Thank you.
I have to say this is an exceptional show tonight. I am in the process of researching a group of grunt Civil War veterans who served together myself. So this is really touching on something I'm very intrigued in. But my question is, when you were looking earlier into the different possibilities of different ways the war could have run. I know many people thought James Buchanan was probably one of the worst presidents we had. In fact, I think Harry Truman himself also said so. My question is, what is the panel's thoughts on if the war had started during the Buchanan administration? Would it simply have been appease the South and let it end, or would he have actually fought the war out?
Well, in a certain sense, it did at least begin during the Buchanan administration, because the seeds are certainly planted with Lincoln's election. And, of course, while Lincoln's elected in November, he doesn't take office until the following March. So the withdrawal from the Union does begin then. And while Buchanan makes a gesture toward reinforcing Fort Sumter, he takes the general position that while it's unconstitutional to leave the Union, the presidency has no capacity to stop it from proceeding. So he basically defaults on, in my opinion, on the responsibility of the Union to hold itself together.
Okay, so then you have the opinion then maybe kind of a lame duck appearance and just, I'm going to ride this out and wait for this to be somebody else's.
Which is what Buchanan does, and then it's Lincoln's responsibility to pick up the pieces. A number of forts and arsenals are already lost during the end of Buchanan's administration to armies of the Confederacy. And by the time Lincoln comes into office, there are only two or three installations left in Union hands. One of them is Fort Sumter.
And, you know, to me, Buchanan is sort of a poignant figure. In fact, somebody said that I was sort of too sympathetic to Buchanan in my book. Now, I do think that he was a terrible president. I think that if he had remained president for much longer, it would have been a complete disaster. And if on the other hand, a stronger person had been there, then possibly the war could have ended much more quickly and with a more decisive early victory by the North. But I also think I find him a poignant figure in that he sort of embodied this value of compromise that is, after all, a very basic value of our democracy, the idea that that our society has to be built on, to some degree, moderation and equivocation. He was a man who had great long experience in government, in some ways the best qualified person ever to become president compared to Lincoln, who had very few qualifications. So I think that while it's easy to vilify him, I also find him at least a little bit sympathetic.
Sir, thank you for the call. We pause for a last round of entrepreneurial modules, and we return directly after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
We don't tell you often enough about all the fine podcasts available for you on our website. There are literally hundreds of them available, and on the very front first page, there are perhaps 30 or so that you can quickly download, or you can listen to them streaming instantly. And one of them I'm going to read it to you. This is an Extension 720 classic, meaning it's from 5 years ago or longer. Lincoln, A Life of Purpose and Power. Richard Carwardine, do I say that name correctly? You
yes.
guys know him? Discusses the new biography, including, it was new then, including Lincoln's thoughts on race, religion, and the causes of the Civil War. I don't quite remember this conversation, but it was good enough for us to put it up as an Extension 720 classic. While I'm talking about that, if you go to the website, and you get there by going to simply wgnradio.com/extension720, here are some of the things you'll find on the first page. You will find recent programs, including the one we did just last night on the state of Catholicism. Among the classics in the archives available to you on the front page, a conversation with Henry Kissinger, a conversation with David Mamet, one that I particularly favor, with Frederick Cruz, a great debunker and a great literary scholar himself, his book on a titled Follies of the Wise, and Who Wrote Shakespeare, etc., etc. Another classic, Churchill and America. We speak with Sir Martin Gilbert, Churchill's official biographer, about Churchill's unique relationship with America. Just up recently, because Trey Elling, our producer, managed to discover them and to get them uploaded, so they are there for you right now, a classic discussion with Gordon Liddy. Yes, Gordon Liddy is still a talk show host, though I think he's not heard in the Chicago area. But we talked with him when he was just out of prison, and we talked about Watergate with him. This is a very old one. It goes way back to the year 1980. Also, a classic, an Extension 720 classic, with, since we've just inaugurated the new mayor of Chicago, I remember when another mayor was inaugurated, namely Harold Washington. And this is a conversation with Harold Washington dating back to 1984. I just listened to a portion of it again a day or two ago, and I was fascinated by it. He was a great performer. And one that I am quite delighted by, a conversation going back to 1987 with Henry Haller. You probably don't recognize that name, but he was the White House executive chef for some 20 years. And by then, in 1987, he had taken his retirement, and he did a book. And he had wonderful stories about cooking for four different presidential families. With that, we had better get quickly back to the phones. 312-591-7200. And whatever I've got there, I don't want it. But we go next to John, and you are on the air, sir. Please go ahead.
Yes, gentlemen, good evening. Really enjoying the show, and ironically, I'm driving through the state of Georgia right now.
Be careful.
Yes, absolutely. I was focus group about 10, 15 years ago, and it was focusing in on the Emancipation Proclamation, the document itself. And a couple of points were brought up, and a couple of points since the 150th anniversary were kind of brought up once again. About the document itself, from basically what we surmised from it, it was, number one, a rather hastily prepared document. Obviously, there were pointed reasons strategically with the war why the document was released so quickly, and a couple of really interesting, almost humorous omissions from the document itself, which, of course, was a wonderful document. However, if you take it literally, number one, really seriously questioned the constitutionality of the document. It wasn't ratified by Congress for several months after it was done. And number two, if you take it literally, it only actually freed slaves in states that were in rebellion to the United States. So other states, you know, specifically Missouri, Kentucky, Delaware, New Jersey, technically, even after the Emancipation Proclamation was issued, slavery was still technically legal. Would be interested in the comments on that. Really enjoying the show and looking forward to reading the book. Thank you and good evening.
Thank you, sir. Glad to have heard from you, gentlemen.
Well, this is a document that Lincoln issues as an expression of his war powers as commander-in-chief. And it's his opinion that he has the right to emancipate slaves only in places that are in rebellion against the United States at that point. So it's it may seem ironic, but actually it's perfectly logical that this is a step whose limits are constrained by his interpretation of his constitutional rights and obligations. The fact remains, however, that the breaking down of slavery in the states already in rebellion has the indirect effect of weakening it everywhere because, among other things, slaves in those states that are not covered by the Emancipation Proclamation, if they can get away from their owners, can slip down into those other states and then present themselves to Union armies as slaves of active Confederates and achieve emancipation, which is exactly what does occur.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's been overstated. It's become a sort of a mantra. The Emancipation Proclamation did not free a single slave, which some people actually sort of, ironically, it's used sometimes by these neo-Confederate types to say, well, see, the Union War was not actually a war to free the slaves, that Lincoln really was not committed to freeing the slaves. And that's really overstated because the Emancipation Proclamation, what it did was it said that slavery as a system, if the Union wins, is over. It's over in these seceded states, and I think that the border slave state owners understood that the writing was on the wall for them as well. But, you know, even more importantly, as Bruce just suggested, the slaves themselves understood that this meant the imminent end of the institution, and they did much, as they had already since the beginning of the war been doing much to hasten its end. And word of that proclamation spread very quickly through the South. You know, there are these stories about, oh, the Southerners, the masters didn't tell their slaves about the Emancipation Proclamation. Some of these stories say, you know, for years and years after the war. Well, that is also just specious. The word spread very fast, and the slaves took this as a charter of their freedom.
There's one story about a Union officer interviewing a bunch of Confederate POWs and asking them what effect the Emancipation Proclamation had on them. And they said, it played hell with us. And then the Union officer said, how could that be? Because the slaves are illiterate. And the Confederate POWs respond, well, I don't know. But in fact, I heard about the Emancipation Proclamation first from my slave. So there's an underground, what they call grapevine telegraph, running through some major sections of the slave community that carries this kind of information sure. far and wide.
With that, gentlemen, back to the phones. People are very eager to get through, and we only got about 5 minutes left. So we go quickly to the next caller. Nancy has joined us. Good evening.
Good evening. Yes. Through necessity, through various wars, there's usually technological advances. World War II came to jet aircraft, frozen orange juice concentrate, for example. You think about the submarine in the Civil War, even though the predecessors in the Revolutionary War. What kind of technological advances are associated with the Civil War?
Well, of course, all kinds of military advances, and most notably the ironclad warship. And very quickly after the Civil War, the wooden navies of really all of the major Western powers very quickly become obsolete.
How about canned food? Have you ever heard that?
Yeah, I've heard about that, when they had canned food for in the Civil War.
Canned
even
food,
though it was out of iron or something, where it was actually poison?
Yeah, well, canned food was being developed, as I understand it, and I'm not an expert in this, before the war. One thing I know that was an interesting outgrowth of the war is standard sizes in men's clothing, sort of pre-made clothing, and it came from all those hundreds of thousands of Union Army uniforms. So the sort of standardization in production does get a big boost from the war.
Another technological change is the tremendous use of railroads to move armies over vast differences. Both sides made great use of it, arguably the Confederacy even more than the Union.
Ma'am, we thank you for the call. We've got about 3 minutes left, so my apologies to those who are still waiting online. But let's just talk a bit about the industry you both belong to. That is, one might say, borrowing from the Bible and parodying, of the making of books about the Civil War, there is no end. And you two have done great books about the Civil War. Probably you intend to do yet others. It has been predicted that, I did read someplace just today as I was boning up for things tonight, that by the year 1990, there had been 150,000 books about the Civil War. Does that sound reasonable?
One sees different estimates. The ones I've 50,000? Seen,
I'm not sure.
Yeah, are more sort of in the range of 50,000 to 70,000.
I guess I got that wrong.
It is still, it's more than one book for every day since the surrender at Appomattox. Or another way you could put it is it's one book for every soldier, both Northern and Southern, who fought at the first Battle of Bull Run.
And now that we're into the sesquicentennial, it is expected that over the next 4 years there will be many, many books sort of timed to coincide with, say, the Battle of Gettysburg, et cetera.
No doubt. And there already are separate books on each day in the Battle of Gettysburg, so
yes,
we can only expect this cornucopia to yield more.
Who, in terms of your own estimation and your own pleasure and your own admiration, who are the two or three greatest historians of the Civil War totally?
Well, I'm a great admirer. We were actually talking about this a little bit, Bruce and I, before the show. Great admirer of Bruce Catton, who was really the great historian at the time of the centennial, and whose reputation has been overshadowed a little bit in recent years by what was the name of that guy who was in the Ken Burns document?
The Southern guy,
Shelby Foote. Yeah,
Shelby,
exactly.
Foote.
The Southern guy. And Catton, I think, is being resurrected a little bit now, which is wonderful.
My favorite is James McPherson, the author of Battle Cry of Freedom and many, many other books.
I'm happy to say he's been on this program 3 or 4 times over the years.
I think he's the best. Eric Foner has just written the Pulitzer Prize-winning book on Lincoln and slavery. That's the best book on that subject. And there's an outfit called the Freedmen and Southern Society Project at the University of Maryland, pumping out an encyclopedia on the subject.
And with that, we come to the end of the available time. My guests have been Adam Goodhart and Bruce Levine. Adam Goodhart's new book is titled 1861, The Civil War Awakening. Oh, and Bruce Levine's most recent book, Half Slave and Half Free. You are going to be
At the Union League, the Union League Club of Chicago tomorrow. And if readers want, they should call the Abraham Lincoln Bookshop to come to that event.
And with that, we will wind down. Tenting Tonight on the Old Camp Ground, a Civil War song. And thanks to all for listening. We'll be back again Sunday after the ballgame. That's at around 11 o'clock.